Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, where the senior editors of your very favorite magazine for free minds and free markets convene each Monday or Tuesday in case of long weekend holiday to shout about the news. I am Matt Welch, joined by my Reason colleagues, Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Raise your hand if you have electricity.
I do. Howdy.
Living the dream in SoCal right now, Matt Welch. Don't need electricity when you got nature on your side.
Thank you.
Happy Monday from a very electrified Washington, D.C.
Wow. No Texas here. That's, we're myopic about the real America who's suffering.
I lived in Texas for 2 years, Matt. So
just out,
I've done
just
my
out
time.
There pulling the execution lever.
I did a clubhouse room with some people from Texas last night.
Why are you hitting the spoiler button here, Suderman?
That actually sounded like real sinister for some reason, and maybe rightly so. We'll get to it later, right?
All I know is that, and I know I'm not supposed to talk about workplace Slack here, but except when it's about Jacob Sullum, Jacob Sullum's Slack travails about what he's doing to...
He literally just posted that he's looking for firewood right now. Like, that can't be good.
He's out, like, chopping elm trees or something. All right, listen, we're going to talk about lots of actual things besides Jacob Sullum on this podcast. They include, but are not, are not limited to impeachment, Bidenomics. And if history is any guide, we might have a word or two to say about the super science-y recommendations from the Center for Disease Control last Friday about schools. But before any of all of that, here, the Institute for Justice has a terrific podcast called Bound by Oath that examines in depth how it is that the government has immunity for violating constitutional rights and what us peons can do about it. The podcast explores the stories of people who have fought the hell back, interviewing the lawyers who help them out and the legal scholars who can say fancy Latin phrases on command. You can find Bound by Oath wherever you can find podcasts, which basically at this point is everywhere. Take a listen today. You'll be glad you did. Okay, so on Valentine's Eve, in a development that carried all the drama of a Washington Generals game, the Senate, for the second time in 2 years, voted to acquit Donald Trump of impeachment, this time on a vote of 57-43 in favor of a single count of incitement to insurrection, but that was short of the two-thirds required for conviction. It looks like we probably won't have a rule of three in this case on impeachment, so this might be... Just put down a marker here. This might be the last time we speak of impeaching Donald Trump on the Reason Roundtable podcast. So, Catherine, editor-in-chief of the Reason Universe, what did we learn today?
We relearned something, which is how things have been going lately. We relearned that impeachment is political. We relearned that it is not a legal proceeding. It is not even really much of a fact-finding mission. It is mostly a way of doing political theater. I don't know if it was always true. I think probably it was always true that impeachments were political theater. But
well, typically we weren't always doing an impeachment.
Right. But I mean, we have done them before, right? And perhaps all of them were in fact political theater before, for the most part. But I do think that we would do well to keep that in mind. I remain a partisan of the Gene Healy theory of impeachments, which is to say, impeach more presidents more of the time. And I guess in the case of Donald Trump, impeach this particular president more times. But I think that view, on my part at least, has been tempered by an increasing awareness of how very, very, very partisan, tribal, and theatrical this impeachment proceeding and perhaps all impeachment proceedings are. And so we should keep in mind that there's a larger element of sideshow than we might have hoped.
Nick, the world is a stage. And if that's all true, it's like the acting.
Matt, did you just have a mini stroke, or were you trying to do an accent?
This whole thing is a mini stroke. This is the dream that Tommy has been having this entire time. No, it seems like the acting is worse. That's one thing, especially from my point of view, the Republicans trying to make
you know, insincere arguments about how this violates the First Amendment. Maybe you have a different view. But what does this tell you, all these things, about particularly the modern state or the state of the modern Republican Party?
Boy, I didn't expect it to go there. But, the Republican Party...
I guess it was the Slack pre-conversation about talking about what was going to happen to the Republican Party.
Yeah.
But go on.
I think one of the things that is becoming clearer is that the Republican Party, like the Democratic Party, does not have a strong, enduring character. It changes when they win a presidential election. Everybody is like, okay, this party's back, Matt. You know, this is an old story for you and I, who once long ago in a different universe wrote a book called The Declaration of Independence, where we talked about the rise of, of elections where, you know, nobody's really winning anymore because neither the Republicans nor the Democrats represent, even a plurality, a reliable plurality, much less a majority of American voters. The Republicans somehow managed between November and January 6th to turn, you know, a pretty good showing in a national election into a catastrophe by Donald Trump's antics. They're still sticking with Trump. Well, you know, when you look at those stupid polls that mean absolutely nothing about, among Republicans, who's your favorite presidential candidate for 2024 as well as 2028 and forever into the future? Donald Trump has like 52% of the vote or something. But it's not really Trump's party. They don't know what they're doing. And I think this was revealed here, just as the Democrats didn't know what they were doing and has been revealed time and time again, basically in every other election. So I think what we've learned about the Republican Party is that there's a group of some people, and this would include people who have less in common than they might think, but people like Peter Meyer, the new Republican congressman who took Justin Amash's vacated seat, and Mitt Romney, who's been hanging around the fringes of national politics forever, that they are,
Like, is he?
I want the steak.
I had him more like he's like in the morgue.
Yeah.
But I actually, Matt's more wholesome, like, it's midnight. He's like looking in the fridge, like he's kind of snacky, but he doesn't know what he wants to eat.
There are signs that the Republican Party is going to come up with some kind of personality between now and the midterms. If they're smart, they'll probably just not do anything because the Democrats are already laying the groundwork for a significant defeat in the midterm elections for all sorts of reasons.
We'll get to all of those
sorts
of reasons.
If I may say just real quickly, I mean, I think what impeachment showed, is that like the institutions held pretty well. As Catherine was saying, it's political. It was done as political theater. We went through it. It's done. And now we're on to the next thing.
Suderman, you're the institutionalist here, and I suspect you might have a more pessimistic take than Nick. I will tee you up by Jonathan Rauch, who has a very pessimistic take about Trump and our modern politics these days. He's a longtime Reason contributor and a friend and a smart thinker. Had a post-impeachment acquittal thread, and I'll just read the last of his thread, which is, "And more than ever, there's a howling void at the center of the Constitution, one called Congress." Do you agree with that assessment?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the lesson of impeachment the second time around is that Republicans think Trump did it. They think he's guilty. They think that he's guilty without question. They just don't want to do anything about it. I'm being a little bit uncharitable, but that's basically what Mitch McConnell said, right? There is no question that President Trump is practically and morally responsible for provoking the events of January 6th. That's a way of saying he's guilty. The people who stormed the building believed they were acting on the wishes and instructions of their president. Trump was responsible. And yet McConnell voted to acquit. And he did so because of, his sacred constitutional obligation that he has not to convict someone who currently holds no office. Now, I admit this is a matter that is in dispute, but it's not something that McConnell believes so much that he thinks that the Republicans who voted to convict Trump were wrong in any real way, right? He also has this like totally this thing where he's just like, we have to, people agree to disagree on this. There's a variety of opinions. That's a completely normal way to think about this, too. It just so happens that the bulk of the Republican Party viewed this one way, and all the Democrats viewed it the other way. And the other thing, though, that is, you know, sort of notable here is McConnell personally made it effectively impossible to get a conviction by delaying the proceedings. And now his argument is, well, the normal court system should come into play. And Trump should maybe, he's not quite saying should, he's saying could be tried in the courts. So I just sort of have a couple of questions coming out of this. And the main one is, does McConnell believe the Senate, a co-equal branch of the government, has no constitutional way to respond to a president who, in McConnell's own words, has a practical and moral responsibility for inciting a deadly attack on the Senate that was designed specifically to interrupt a core constitutional proceeding, which is the certification of a presidential vote? It seems like McConnell thinks that there's just no way, we just can't do it. And it's really telling. I mean, just so telling that in the end, McConnell wants to kick this to the courts, because that is the McConnell philosophy in a nutshell. The Senate exists to do tax cuts and gigantic spending bills, and absolutely everything else is a matter for the courts. His hands are tied. Total abdication of responsibility.
What? Why do you say that Republicans couldn't have voted to convict? Nobody was holding a gun to the head.
Because their argument for not voting to convict was not that Trump was not guilty. It was that to convict someone who no longer holds office is unconstitutional.
Yeah, no, that, but they don't have to. I don't understand why you're acting as if Mitch McConnell is, the Voldemort or something. You know, these guys and women have brains.
Sure,
and
although
some
you
will
just argued that they don't know what they're doing. And I think McConnell knows exactly what he's doing here, right?
I think what Peter's saying, let me attempt to save time, is that McConnell did a procedural act that gave them a bigger fig leaf to do what they were going to do.
And look, you've got guys like Rubio who are releasing statements
like this one.
The election is over. A new president is in the White House and a new Congress has been sworn in. Let history and, if necessary, the courts judge the events of the past. Notice what he just doesn't say. Joe Biden won the election in a free and fair election. And so what we are going to be left with here is a party that is a pure personality cult that allows, if not actively encourages, lingering questions about the legitimacy of the election, about the legitimacy of the entire sort of electoral process. We are going to be left with a shakier and less stable system, one that may sort of still be holding together, but it doesn't seem to me like these institutions are holding. It seems to me like these institutions are breaking down. And I think, you know, in the same way that in 2015, when Donald Trump first stepped down that elevator and announced he was running for president, it was
escalator.
It was somewhat clear that that represented something bad and a rot at the heart of the Republican Party and American politics more generally. And you couldn't predict exactly what was going to happen. You couldn't predict precisely the events of January 6th, but it was clear that the odds were very high, not certain, but very high, that things would start to come apart. And I think that the trend here in the Republican Party to kind of not admit that this election that was won by Joe Biden, to, again, to allow, if not encourage, these questions about the election, and to basically say, we're not ever going to take any action against Donald Trump, and we're going to let him sort of rule us, the king from beyond, right? Even though he's not in power anymore, it's just very worrying. And again, I don't know what's going to happen and what's going to come from this. Maybe nothing. But again, you could have said that in 2015 and you would have been right for a couple of years. But things just, I mean, we saw where things went and it wasn't good.
Catherine, first of all, I don't know why you have to say pure personality cult when impure personality cult is also available to you as a descriptor. And in general, I think everyone still has so much Trump on the brain and thinks in top down ways that we discount the bottom up ways. Maybe the cult is about Trump voters and not the actual man himself. And that has a lot to do with the behavior of Republican politicians. They're scared of their own voters having the various sympathies. But Catherine, to make this in the form of a question that's absolutely different, what does it tell you that what does it tell you that Nancy like
Matt
Pelosi
was
not-
a you did you used to interrogate people at Gitmo or something? Because the you. Way you're it's very discombobulating, Matt Welch.
I like it. Go ahead.
And I mean that in a good way.
You can go back to your nap on the West Coast there. Catherine, what does it tell you that Nancy Pelosi not once but twice while prosecuting an impeachment, is that what you do, prosecute? I don't know. While doing an impeachment, did not choose to include a Republican in the managers of the trial?
I think that, again, it just shows that this is a tribal, partisan, theatrical activity, that there was never really any doubt of how this was going to come out, and that the manufactured sense of tension about whether Republicans would flip, it was largely that it was largely theatrical and manufactured, both by Democrats who hoped it might happen and by the press that hoped something interesting might happen. And I think that stuff like Nancy Pelosi's choice there shows that the kind of more hard-boiled, and McConnell's conduct shows that the more hard-boiled types on the Hill had a clearer sense of direction and knew how this was going to go down and just were kind of moving through it as brutally and quickly as possible.
I would add,
but I mean, this was about like stitched together videos with, you know, like high drama. I mean, you know, the thing that people were talking about from this entire impeachment was basically how good the AV was. Like there was like the little video vignettes that they inserted were better than most of the Zoom galas we've attended, right? Like it was well produced. And
it was better than the DNC.
That ain't right. Like something's a little wrong there.
This was prosecution by TikTok.
It was prosecution by TikTok. That actually makes it sound good. I'm sort of for that.
No, but the Democrats put I didn't think that there should have been an impeachment trial going into this, but I think they did an incredibly good job of presenting a case against Donald Trump. And that's not a
but
small
it didn't matter,
function.
Right? Like that's my claim is that it mostly
well,
did
but
not
it's not a small function because I disagree with Peter's pessimism that, you know, this is going to linger, you know, and degrade things more than they are already. But we got a case out there that is very convincing. And the Republicans showed that they were not capable or interested in rebutting it. So, you know, I think it served that function as a kind of pure informational, you know, exercise. And it's
yes.
not a small thing.
And you know, one could argue, Catherine, that like you can, yes, it's going to be political theater. Yes, the acting is worse than ever. A lot of this foregone conclusion. But if Congress is ever going to begin the process of taking more seriously its constitutional duties, then it needs to do any kind of oversight, but also it needs to do its work more seriously. And to the extent to which that there is any seriousness in that, in this exercise, you want to give them at least a mid five, not necessarily a high five for the whole thing, is one argument. But let's go to the 46th president. Enough of 45. Just
wait,
seriously,
who is 46? Is that Kamala or is it still Biden?
Thank you for not being racist in your pronunciation there. That's what I appreciate the most.
I mean, I think the one thing we can agree on is that it's actually kind of a relief to get beyond Donald Trump, hopefully, at least for a little while. My worry is that we won't.
Sounds like a guy who doesn't have kids in school.
Yeah.
Anyways, Peter.
doesn't care about the future. I don't know. You know,
we've had in the past week or so Treasury Secretary and former Fed Chief Janet Yellen out there saying that globalization is bad. Okay. Biden is extending national security tariffs. Well done, everybody, for not reading Scott Lipscomb.
He's like Trump's second term, Matt Welch. How many kids is he separate?
Christ.
He's putting kids in smaller cages or bigger cages? But they're cages, right?
And we have, you know, scientists putting on their science hats to make the arguments for stimulus relief bills there. So what can you tell us, Peter, about our industrial policyist in chief?
Yeah, I think it's actually worth thinking back to the Democratic primary. And so if you remember, this was all, you know, mostly pre-COVID, right? A completely different world. There were debates, like people actually saw each other in person. It was just a very strange time. But there were a whole bunch of folks on stage. Mostly, though, there were really just three people representing three broad camps. Yes, this is a gloss. So there was Bernie, and Bernie stood for democratic socialism, for Medicare for all, for being old and from Vermont. And there was Elizabeth Warren, who stood for kind of the same thing, except she claimed to be a capitalist to her bones or something like that. And she wanted to regulate and manage every single economic interaction you could possibly think of. If you had an idea to exchange money for goods or services, Elizabeth Warren had a plan to regulate it. And then there were a bunch of bandwagoners in something resembling the Warren and Bernie molds, right? Sort of following on. And Harris, actually, I would say, is sort of triangulated herself in many ways between the Warren and Bernie camps, though not quite fully embracing, you know, Bernie-style socialism or all of Elizabeth Warren's plans. But what all of them wanted was what Elizabeth Warren often described as big structural change. And then there was Joe Biden, and he was the moderate. He was the centrist. He was running against Trump, not the entire American economic system. He was not the candidate of big structural change. He was effectively running on a promise to return things to normal, right? That's what he was there to do. Well, now he's president, and it turns out he has a lot of plans, and they don't represent a return to normal. Instead, Biden has embraced a kind of Bernie Warren light theory of economic policy. Certainly has not adopted all of the Bernie Warren agenda, but he has moved in their direction in a really a kind of decisive way. And he has become the candidate of big structural change. So a lot of that is just spending $1.9 trillion for starters right out the gate. That's part one of two this year. But it's also becoming clear, as you hinted, that Biden wants to implement a kind of new industrial policy, one built on a combination of subsidies for American labor, various government-funded infrastructure programs, including old favorites like high-speed rail, various forms of support for middle-class families, starting with pandemic relief checks, but also a sizable temporary increase in the child tax credit. The Democrats have already said, yeah, after we pass this for a year or two, we want to make it permanent. And then tariffs and trade barriers that are supposed to prop up American manufacturing jobs. So a lot of the inspiration from this, somewhat amazingly, comes from a big picture policy document that was actually published by the American Auto Workers Union back in 2018. This comes from a New York Times report last week. And, you know, I'm pitching this as something kind of new for the Democratic Party. It's not entirely. There are certainly connections to green jobs initiatives of the Obama presidency. We all remember those and the high-speed rail projects. But what's really strange, I think, is the way that this harkens back not to Obama, but to Trump. And not in every particular and not in every sort of policy detail, but in the way that it just sort of has this general aura of protectionism, even mercantilism. It sense that the U.S. economy would be best off if it was managed from the top, closed off to the world in many ways, built around mid-century factory-style jobs that were heavily subsidized by federal spending. All right, I just want to I will finish this just by reading a little tiny bit from that New York Times report, which is really notable. And I mean, like, it's really interesting and you should all read it. But it said, when aides eventually described the ideas in the United Auto Workers paper, Biden became animated. This was on the campaign trail. The notion that spending billions to upgrade plants and subsidize car buying could save the livelihoods of today's workers, not merely create jobs for their kids, excited him. It promised a marriage of present and future. That's what we're going to get for the next 4 years, folks. And part of the problem of Trump sort of lingering over the Republican Party is that we are not going to have a smart, effective opposition to this.
Let's remember, Nick Gillespie, that Joe Biden at the 2012 Democratic National Convention, his big applause winner was General Motors is alive and Osama bin Laden is dead.
That's right.
Damn it.
I kind of envy Osama bin Laden, you know, when I hear that.
Just to throw another, you know, unplanned curveball.
Another Ephus pitch.
Another Uncle Charlie. Nick.
People could see Matt Welch right now is on his knees petting the ground like Mark Fidrich getting ready in his great season for the Detroit Tigers.
His only...
talking to the ball, doing unspeakable things on the mound.
He was so good.
Where were we, Matt?
We were at... I'm interested in
I just want to alienate the Gen Z people on this podcast as quickly as possible, right?
Catherine is just like floating in some other universe. She's like getting caught up in her young adult fiction reading.
And Peter's playing
Catherine's
Candy
watching
Crush.
Impeachment TikTok videos.
Isn't that what the kids play now all the time? They're on their smartphones, Matt Welch.
Catherine, which Democratic senator would do the best like hand moves on the TikTok dancing?
Oh, I don't know. I mean,
is it Chuck Schumer?
If you follow the old line about how the most dangerous place in Washington is between Chuck Schumer and a microphone, I do think there is some sort of natural Chuck Schumer lip syncing to an AOC clip. While dancing on TikTok is that's coming in the next 6 months.
I'd love to see him dancing on a roof like she did in college, right? That would be nice.
How dare she dance in college? I'm still mad about it.
Yeah. No, she's not no American does that.
So, Nick, to formulate this into a question and to build on your already irritating, second Trump presidency thing, but because Suderman extended it, right? To the extent that Biden is going protectionism, Yellen is out there. Democratic Treasury secretaries and Fed chiefs are supposed to be, Robert Rubin and Larry Summers, not people
who are... What does that mean? People who are contemptible in their own particular ways?
Absolutely awful human beings.
Larry
who
Summers,
are nevertheless
who
reliably
is, didn't
neoliberals?
We go through this whole thing with Larry Summers as E.T. or K-Pak or something? He's the E.T. dressed up, the kids bringing him out to town.
I think we need a Larry Summers segment on every podcast from now on.
Just Jabba the Hutt TikTok, that's all. at the end of the Trump presidency, public opinion for trade support.
It's not over, Matt. This is the interregnum, okay? We're in the middle of the Trump presidency.
Grant me a psychic gun.
Wow, I would read that comic book.
I'm going to send Loki over to Suderman here in a second. Public support for free trade is high. And yet we've had two Trumps in a row who are out there being all mercantilisty. What is that, Nick?
Well, Matt, China is everywhere. They've already, they're laying a groundwork through TikTok, even though it's not really Chinese anymore. And it never really was in terms of the information they were getting. But, we're a subsidiary of the CCP.
Do you think that is more of a function like the pro support for trade was just kind of anti-Trump? Do you think there's a thick anti-trade sentiment in America that is so we're getting the politics that are being driven by from the ground up? How do you analyze this sort of extended anti-globalist moment we're having in American politics and policy?
Well, one thing that is always worth reminding ourselves of is that, parties want you to see political eras in terms of there was Carter and then there was Reagan and there's this clean break and we're moving into fresh territory and, towards the light or something. And, Reason has talked about this in particular that, people like LBJ and Richard Nixon were very similar. Richard Nixon completed the Great Society through regulatory reform that Ronald Reagan in many ways extended and actually kind of slowed down, but was in the universe of Jimmy Carter's deregulatory moves across various things. I think, and this actually continues something that Peter was getting at, we are in an era now of intense anxiety about everything. And this was true under Obama, but it was specifically true. This is what Trump really tapped into, our anxiety about stuff and the idea that, the president or the government, which we have less and less faith and less respect for, confidence for, both the institution as well as the idiot individuals who are actually running it, who are now 800,000 years old. I mean, the immortals, the ancients in Lovecraft stories are younger than the gerontocracy that's running America now. But what we want is a managed society, or that's what the political class is. It's all on the variation of managing things. It's throwing a weighted blanket over every aspect of our lives. And, you know, we're seeing that in the economy. Now, it was kind of true under Trump. You remember he was calling up air conditioner manufacturers in Indiana and saying, hey, you know, you got to stay here. You know, you got to stay here. Republicans like Scott Walker, if I'm remembering his name, I don't, you know, but, you know, with the Foxconn deal in Wisconsin and stuff, this was all on the right side of the ledger. Everybody was talking about how we're going to, you know, create a better economy, and they're managing everything. They're getting in, you know, they're opening up machines and trying to fiddle with them. That's what's happening with Biden, who I think is more effective. And he is, you know, he's the Perry Como to, you know, I don't know, to Trump Sinatra. You know, one kind of upset things, but was a crooner. The other one is kind of the smooth guy who's going to make it okay, who's wearing the cardigan, but is going to smother us even more. And I think this is the thing that bothers me the most about the emerging Biden era. And this is on the Republican side and on the Democratic side, is that it is just one of managing every aspect of our lives. It's bigger than politics and culture. People seem, you know, outside of libertarians, people seem to want somebody who can manage everything and keep things kind of under wraps or under control. This, you know, in media, you know, we see this more and more where, you know, journalists are leading the charge for regulating and silencing other journalists and media. If we're going to talk about Clubhouse at some point, you know, the idea that journalists are saying, you know, it's really dangerous that you have a bunch of people talking freely in a place that doesn't leave a digital footprint. So you can't track down people's tweets or comments from 300 years ago and hold them accountable at some future point and things like that. This is the era we're in. We went from in the 90s when I joined Reason, everybody was talking about temporary autonomous zones, the way that the internet and other technologies would allow us to escape control and regulation and, you know, buy and sell and create our own freak flags, fly them, start our own societies and live, you know, in some approximation of freedom. Now it's those same kinds of tools are being used to track everything we do, to regulate, modulate, and moderate anything we're doing. It's not good.
Hey, Catherine, insert Hayek here. And also specifically to the question of, I say that because I know you can and should, but also like, what is the problem, both theoretically and very practically, with the rise of a managerial, or the re-rise of a managerial class?
Because managers get things wrong. That was my insert Hayek here, I guess. I didn't mean to do it, but
sweet.
I did it.
No deadlines for me.
I did it.
Wait, oh. Catherine, aren't you a manager?
Yeah, and I sure do get things wrong. And luckily for y'all, I manage only via consent and not at the point of a gun like all of these other jerk faces we're talking about here. Yeah, no, this is, you know, we have bazillion examples all around us every day of the ways in which, if you give people power over sections of the economy, they screw it up. And Donald Trump certainly proved that in spades. And then Joe Biden rolled in and was like, yeah, that guy seems like he was onto something. I'm going to keep doing those. And that's going to end badly for all of us, but especially those of us who just want to have cheap stuff and the free movement of people and ideas and things across borders, because that makes our lives better. And the idea that somehow Joe Biden and Janet Yellen and a bunch of other, as Nick says, like Lovecraftian ancients can put their tentacles in exactly the right place in our economy and solve all of our problems is absurd on its face, disgusting in the particular way that I just described it, and will not in the end increase efficiency. Which is all I want in this world.
You know,
increased efficiency.
This is also
no tentacles.
You know, like a robot.
The way that both Biden and especially Kamala Harris are talking about equity, not equality. This is a theme that is permeating every aspect of a Biden administration. That is about specifically and explicitly at a site called The 19th. Harris gave an interview where she talked about, you know, equity means outcomes are the same. And what we're talking about here is managing not just expectations and not just creating processes or structures in which everybody has equal opportunity. And that would mean a lot of upping, you know, of things like school choice and all kinds of things, but outcomes across every aspect of life.
Kamala Harris and for Handicapper General, right? It's Harris and Bergeron all the way.
Whatever else you say about that, it means that, you know, from start to finish, the government is going to be sitting on your shoulder and saying, okay, that's good enough, stop here, or we need to do more. And it is just suffocating even thinking about it, much less what we're going to be living through.
Peter, talk about that. I know you talk a lot about healthcare and about the macroeconomic picture, but it's also true that Joe Biden ran as, compared to the rest of the field, especially and not only compared to Kamala Harris, he was the non-woke guy, right? He was the one who dared to say that we shouldn't return forced busing into school districts, and yet here we are throwing equity.
School districts, weren't they a thing?
We're highlighting equity at every turn, and to a degree that I think surprises most people. I mean, I'm actually surprised by it, and it could have incredible implications. Can you chew on that Harrison Bergeronification a bit more, and how that might play out, and how that might not always be the greatest idea for reviewing, you know, regulatory processes?
Sure. We talked about Harrison Bergeron a while ago on this podcast, and it's a short story by Kurt Vonnegut, basically, in which there's a future in which everyone has been forced into equality. So if you have a special talent of some sort, there is a government official who has the title Handicapper General, and that person's job is to ensure that your special talent and ability has been handicapped so that you aren't better at anything than anybody else. And so that is the dark possible future of one sort of, I think, mistaken push for equity, which says that what we want are equal outcomes. And the way that that happens is not by bringing people up, but by bringing people down. And it's worrying, I think, that that sort of thinking has infected so much of the policymaking apparatus, of academia, of the education system at nearly every level. I mean, you just see this, Matt. I know you have tangled with these ideas and with this way of thinking personally and directly in New York in a way that I haven't here, but it's really endemic in the education system and in all of the kind of institutions that are closely linked to the public education and to higher education in the United States. And I would say that one of them is the federal government, which now draws from a highly educated elite, not entirely Ivy League, but, you know, a lot of them, like Catherine, know how to sail. And there is just a sort of a really kind of destructive way of thinking about these issues that has taken hold there. And it's really interesting to preview again our forthcoming Clubhouse conversation to see how much those ideas clash with the kind of tech world vision that is still in place, not everywhere out on the West Coast and not in every big tech firm, but that still sort of exists out there, which just sort of says, you know, what we need is a level playing field where people can try to do stuff and try to make the world a better place, and they can use technology to improve the lives of people. And that's what we should be doing. And there is this sort of optimism. Sometimes I think it's an optimism that is not fully earned or justified, but that is useful when your life is devoted to starting businesses and creating things. But often it is that kind of optimism, even unearned and unjustified optimism, that gets us to new places that are and better places. And a sort of the dark way of going about the dark underbelly, let's say, of equity-based thinking is that it just sort of says, well, we can't ever get anywhere new. We can't ever do anything that's going to be better. So what we've got to do is just sort of assume a steady state right now, you know, February 2021, we're kind of in lockdowns forever. The economy is kind of okay, but also kind of messed up. And what are we going to do about that? Let's just sort of work from the assumption that nothing will ever change and certainly nothing can ever be improved. We'll never have any good ideas again. And it's just... it's depressing and it's dark. And even I, as a kind of political pessimist in so many ways, I'm very pessimistic about politics. I am not I'm not nearly as pessimistic about the rest of the world, about technology, about the ability of people to figure out how to better the world and to make it a more interesting and lively place. But I do think that politics kind of fights against that tendency. And that's part of our job as libertarians, is to push back against that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's also really important to bring public choice economics and a kind of postmodern cynicism to politics right now, too, in a really powerful way, because I think what is different this time than when Vonnegut wrote Harrison Bergeron, we're not in a golden era of affirmative action or anything like that. What's actually taking place is an incredibly cynical takeover of the government and of government redistributive apparatus by people who are upper middle class, who are defining middle class upwards, so that all of these programs, like, you know, we've willed away, or we've wished away, the idea that there are limits on what the government can spend. You know, now we're in an age where you're a Republican or a Democrat, who cares? Let's just keep spending more and more money. And you get these weird plans where it's like, we need to subsidize households that are making $150,000. You know, we have to relieve student debt from families who can fucking pay for their college out of pocket, you know, in the name of helping poor people. It is such a grossly cynical ploy by people who are living fat and happy lives, you know, looking at poor people and saying, you know, what we really need to do to help them is to absolve me of any time that I'm uncomfortable, I have to give up something in order to get something else. And that, to me, is a new dimension to what's going on here. And in terms of redistribution, this isn't the Depression. It's not even the Great Society, where it's like, look at people in ghettos, look at people in Appalachia, we've got to help them. It's, you know, I'm part of a two income household and I'm making 100 or 150 grand and I don't want to have to pay for my kids' private college. So give me more money. Give me more this. Give me more that. It's, you know, and I think that's the beginning of an outrage that can actually maybe burn away some of this bullshit that we're, you know, that we're living through right
now.
Yeah,
I mean, the economy is messed up right now in some real ways, but it's mostly people making less than $50,000 a year working in service and hospitality industries, right? And it's mostly young people who are less educated. And where is all this money going that we're going to be spending, right? Where is $1.9 trillion going? A ton of it's going to states that have surpluses. It's going to, as you said, Nick, families that are making $120,000 or $149,000 a year. And it's just, it's not targeted at all. It sort of refuses to look at the reality of the economy that we have right now.
Before we get to our listener question of the week, I wanted to at least inject one quick note about the Friday rollout of guidelines from the CDC about school opening. It was terrible. Read everything that I've ever written about it. That'll explain to it. Or better yet, watch Jake Tapper's grilling of CDC Director Rochelle Walensky about it from this weekend's CNN State of the Union program, which is just very dispiriting if you have a child who's in public education. And if it's anything else, it should definitively tell you, get your child out of public education, or like just create some other new thing, to the extent of which you have an interest of having them go to school 5 days a week in February, or not February, in September. At any rate, the bottom line is that they're stressing that kids need to be separated by 6 feet, even though Walensky herself said last July, when she was just at Harvard talking about this, that, hey, 3 feet's fine. The difference between 6 feet and 3 feet is the difference between having 20 kids in a classroom and 9. The difference between being open 2 days a week or 5, it's huge. It's everything. And even though the CDC doesn't have the authority to tell already opened schools to go get closed, there's a lot of teachers unions, especially, who helped write this document, who were pushing for this to happen, because this means they get more funding, and specifically the $200 billion that's earmarked as part of the relief package. That plus they defined different sort of red zones, green zones, blue zones, because that always works when the federal government does that. And by their basic definition of it, we all all live in red zones, which means you can't really open anything safely. Forget it. It's just masks all the way down and 2 days a week at best forever. It's awful. And I'm just saying that to say it, but also just to very briefly tee up Catherine Mengu Ward, because Politico ran a story saying that the GOP is weaponizing the school issue.
This is such a classic Republicans pounce headline. Like, oh my God, let's read it. GOP tries to weaponize pandemic exhausted parents against Biden. And wait, let's do the subhead too. Aware of this emerging voter demo, the White House is hoping its agenda and relief bill will inoculate it against frustrations.
Oh. Ah!
First of all, no thank you to all of that. Every bit of it.
I just became an anti-vaxxer.
Awful. Second, imagine looking at the world we're living in right now and seeing this. I mean, this is, I guess, my theme of today's podcast is like the brain rot of tribalism. This isn't even the 10th most interesting question about what's going on here. Like, is the GOP in the next election cycle maybe going to be like, hey, Biden didn't do a great job getting schools open again? Yeah, maybe. Sure. Yeah. That seems like a conversation that we might have as part of our partisan politics. But in the meantime, I'm a pandemic exhausted parent and I would like schools to be open. And we could just talk about that directly. And this need to make everything about a sinister Republican plot or something is
yeah, it's a sinister
absurd
Republican plot for Joe Biden to preside over bad instructions for school.
CDC.
Bad governance. CDC yeah. guidelines. Like, it's Republicans are the ones who are, I mean, like.
Yeah, Republicans did that for sure. No, I mean, I do think if we are being incredibly generous, we could say like, okay, listen, it is true that there were some politics to the question of whether or not the CDC was going to issue broad-based guidelines for the country early on. The fact that they're doing it just now does have something to do with the way that our politics have played out. And it might have been helpful to have a single non-binding baseline provided by a highly competent government agency whose whole job is to help us manage pandemics. But no, the CDC was busy deciding whether or not landlords could evict people. Yes, I will keep coming back to that because it makes me so mad. And so they couldn't get around to this until just now. Or maybe Trump stopped them, or maybe Biden made them. Who knows? I do think, though, that, again, let's just kind of go full Hayek here and say local knowledge is so crucial here. So crucial. And we are seeing different school districts do different things. God forbid these CDC guidelines should be used to roll back any of the advances we've made. But I think, you know, increasingly there is an understanding at the local level that schools can reopen safely. Schools are reopening. They are doing it far too slowly for my taste. And as you rightly point out, Matt, the 6-foot guidance is now essentially the deal breaker. But there's always a deal breaker. Like I forget what you said on one of your posts. The goalposts are like they've been airlifted out of the arena or something. First it was teacher vaccinations, then it was masking. Now we have to replace every ventilation system in every school. Plus everyone needs to be 6 feet apart. How are your plexiglass partitions holding up, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Reopen the schools.
Let's now go to our listener question of the week. On each episode of the A Reason Roundtable podcast, we have the privilege of answering a question from you beautiful and handsome people. Those questions can be sent in the following two ways, by email, roundtable@reason.com, or by voicemail, 213-973-3017. Tell us how you want to be identified, if you've got a Twitter account or whatnot. Today's query comes via email from QB. Hey, Catherine, what does QB stand for?
It's also Queen's Bench.
Hey, look at that.
In British law.
Hey, what? And what Dungeons and Dragons thing
actually
is QB,
just think
Peter?
It's a reference to the second coming of the QAnon conspiracy theory. That was QA.
Oh, very good.
This is going to be QB.
Wow. Because it's Biden. He's light on his feet. QB says, should people be granted courtesies that they themselves are not willing to reciprocate. For example, should communists be allowed to speak freely when we know they wouldn't allow us to do the same if they gain control? If your answer is yes, Catherine Mengu Ward, how exactly can libertarians ever deal with bad faith actors?
We should grant courtesies to people who would not extend them to us. This is the baseline of both how etiquette works and also how rule of law works. So let's talk about it for a minute. I think that this is actually like a fundamental misunderstanding about politeness. I want to start with etiquette because you don't do unto others as they did unto you. That's wrong. You don't do unto others even as they would like to do unto you if they were communists who wanted to restrict your free speech rights. You should do unto others, and actually you shouldn't even do unto others as you would like to have done unto you. You should do unto others as they would like to have done unto them. And that is the tricky part, because sometimes it's hard to tell. That's why we create a bunch of basic rules and use those to build our society around. If we tried to only give important freedoms and rights to the people who would respect them and others, no one would have any freedoms or rights. That would end badly. It would be a slippery slope right down to the bottom of a ravine. And instead, what we want, the way that libertarians deal with bad faith actors is we give them the same rights and freedoms as everyone else. When they violate them in others, we punish them. But we don't factor in here what they would do to us or for us. We do what's right because we think it's going to create a just society.
The ends don't justify the means, man. That's my answer.
Yeah. Matt, did your father have a do unto others then split t-shirt or bumper sticker?
No.
After the divorce?
He wasn't. It was internalized more than, he didn't have to keep on trucking. He's just like a little bit too old or young. I'm not sure which, for that to work.
Honorable.
Yes, the right honorable. All right, since we teased Clubhouse a couple of times, let's go to our end-ish of podcasts. What have you been consuming? Because Catherine has been consuming or participating in, I don't understand how this doghouse stuff works. Maybe you can talk to us about what that's like and that could spark a longer conversation. Catherine Mengu Ward.
Yeah. So I did meet some Clubhouse finally. I've been on for a while and I've popped in and out of a few rooms and listened and been kind of like, all right, and then left again. But last week, I noticed that Camille Foster of Fifth Column fame was hosting a room with Justin Amash, late of Libertarian Congress fame. And I was...
Maybe pause for a second. Sorry to interrupt, but just a brief 25 seconds of what Clubhouse is.
So basically what it is it is audio only. And it is a bunch of different rooms that you can join where people are chatting. And it acts something like a panel or one of these kind of luncheons that you can go to in DC sometimes, where a few people are doing most of the talking and a lot of people are listening. But the people who are listening can participate a bit by asking questions. Or otherwise engaging the speakers. Sometimes in the smaller rooms, it's just a roundtable conversation, not unlike this one. But it is, I think, another way to describe it is it's a podcast in which you can participate. And that's why people like it. I think that's the best case for Clubhouse is it's basically a podcast or one of these kind of panels. But you can ask the question you've been thinking of while you're listening. You can participate.
And it doesn't create a permanent record.
It is neither recorded or transcribed, nor is it really formally moderated in any way. So it neither creates a record, nor are there barriers to participation.
Indeed, I believe it is against the terms of service to record conversations that are on Clubhouse.
So this, needless to say, drives some people up the wall. The idea that we could have social media where we can't later, as we said earlier, dig up, you know, a bad tweet from 10 years ago and punish people for it. We can't dig up a bad Clubhouse from a million years ago and punish people for it. You know, that drives people batty. I do want to say, first of all, though, that this Camille Justin Amash room that I joined, it was like 10:30 at night. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. I'll join this room. And before I even fully loaded the room, because I was like not 100% sure how Clubhouse works, I got a little pop-up that was like, be a panelist. And I was like, okay. And then Camille was like, Catherine is now moderating this panel. And I was like, wait, what?
isn't that just like a metaphor for so much of your life?
Yeah, it is. Really, it is. And Connor Friedersdorf was in there too. I don't know if the same thing happened with him or if he was there on purpose. But anyway, it was actually a perfectly interesting conversation. But it was 10:30 at night. And suddenly I was like interviewing Justin Amash. So that happened not entirely on purpose. And I suspect that's happening to other people on Clubhouse right now, though perhaps not that precise, extremely KMW configuration of events. But I do think that Clubhouse is a great example of why we don't need to worry about social media monopolies. That's what I wanted to say about Clubhouse, is just like, oh no, we can't, Donald Trump is blocked from Twitter. He can't speak anymore. It's the First Amendment ruined. No, y'all. Like, admittedly, Clubhouse does just seem to be like fancy Discord, like with fewer features that's available on fewer platforms. Like, it's not actually a huge breakthrough, but
Facebook was not that big an improvement over MySpace and Friendster.
Right.
But so, Facebook was the one that blew up and became the sort of universal tool.
To be fair, Discord like hath already blown up. But yeah, so I do think that, you know,
MySpace was pretty big amongst emo goths.
If the problem with social media is that it's now increasingly going to be moderated and also used to punish you after the fact, hey, look, here's the solution. Look at that. Look at how like a bunch of fancy tech billionaires innovated their way out of this regulatory problem and this cultural problem. Let's see how this one goes. Probably badly. That's okay. We'll try another one later.
Nick, you're going to start your peyote room on Clubhouse?
You know, the good thing is if you're doing it right, Matt, you don't need any hardware for that. You're already there.
Yeah.
Having a lot of conversations with...
Fair enough. Unless anyone else has anything else to say about Clubhouse, I'm going to hit the gavel. I'm going to moderate.
You know, the one thing I think that is worth talking about in this context, one is the absolute moral panic that is happening among people in the media who are like, can you believe, and you know, such paragons of orthodoxy as Vice News denouncing the idea that you can fucking be talking among people that you know or don't know without a permanent record and like a little scold there, you know, some kind of house dwarf who's writing everything down and then funneling it back to the to a central authority is worth taking note of. The other thing I do think, and this is from I am going back more and more after being a huge proponent of Albert Hirschman's Exit, Voice, and Loyalty, the ways in which, you know, he talked about people respond to states and institutions and corporations and communities in decline. I'd always been a big fan of Exit, and I still am. I mean, Exit is the ultimate right. That's what you need. The ability to leave a situation you don't want to, that makes everything better. But I do think sometimes libertarians focus too much on Exit and starting your own moon colony rather than Voice and creating a world in which people are willing to be in the same room with people they disagree with, because I do think that one of the things that what's happening now in politics and more broadly in the culture is the idea that you cannot coexist, and that if somebody somewhere disagrees with me, I have to crush them, as opposed to let's talk or let's find places where we can have a discussion. I think ultimately balancing Exit and Voice is really, you know, that's where we'll find the good society, not falling on the extreme either of Exit and, you know, I'm out of here, you said something that annoys me or frustrates me or I don't understand, fuck you, or in this case, actually, Loyalty, shut up and get with the program, America, love it or leave it, you know, 1619 Project, love it or leave it, and trying to beat people into a consensus is not a good thing either.
Liz Wolf, who, by the way, last night co-hosted a room with like 400 people for several hours on Clubhouse. In her piece about the journalistic panic over Clubhouse, I believe she linked to a Medium page by New York Times TikTok beat coverer Taylor Lorenz, in which she basically, whenever she can get on Clubhouse, because they don't want her to be there, she like collects it immediately, anything that like could potentially offend someone. It is the single most ridiculous journalistic, in air quotes, page I've seen in a very, very long time. It's like, my God, someone used the R word. I can't believe it. And here's a screenshot of everybody's faces who was in the room at the time. And that's what this entire page is devoted to. It's amazing to watch this type of nonsense. All right, Peter Suderman, what have you been consuming?
Well, it was Valentine's Day weekend. So for the first time in my life, I watched Sleepless in Seattle. And it was kind of great. It's got a script by Nora Ephron. Like, it's not maybe her best work. And I still think it sort of fails the as good as When Harry Met Sally test, which is the test for all romantic comedies. If you're not When Harry Met Sally and you're not that good, you kind of don't need to exist. We need one romantic comedy, and it's When Harry Met Sally, which is perfect. But Sleepless in Seattle is pretty good and has some really cute bits and some very nice writing. It's also just such a delightful artifact of early 90s America. And it's sort of just its aesthetic, its view of the world of male-female relationships. There's a whole bit about how shocked Tom Hanks is that when he calls up to ask a woman for a date, she decides the time and like the restaurant and like it. Like she is the one who advances the conversation and sort of takes charge of the asking. And it's like, wow, that's happening. I can't. What is going on in this crazy world between the sexes that like the dogs and the cats? Are they living together? It's just raining. And I don't anyway, it's just so it's really kind of delightful and sweet. And I like. I'm, you know, in some ways that you could say they don't make movies like this anymore, but I think they didn't make movies like this very much back then because Nora Ephron was a one of a kind writer. And it is just, it's nice to go back and see something so sort of pleasant and just sort of sheerly enjoyable. I thought the kids' stuff was a little bit overwrought, but otherwise it's a pretty good movie.
You should wash it down with the acid of the Nora Ephron divorce movie Heartburn, which is a real awful movie. Go ahead.
I just want to say, as a side note to my Clubhouse consumption, my family's Valentine's Day viewing was WALL-E, which I realized could not
super on
be
brand.
More on brand. Not only is it an absolutely fantastic movie about robots in love, it's also, there's no talking in it, you guys. Like, for most of the movie, no one talks. It's all I want. It's love with robots and everyone just shutting the
so you've
fuck
seen
up.
You've seen Up then, right? Which has a great 10-minute life of
I
marriage
can't even
sequence
think about
with
that
no
sequence.
Words at the beginning, although yeah. It also has a lot of really cute funny dogs who talk.
Don't care about the funny dogs,
Nick,
want
and
only
it's got
robots.
An evil corporatist.
We'll accept one small cockroach as
Nick,
animal
Nick,
sidekick.
What was the great 70s Bruce Dern, Huey, Dewey, and Louie robot movie?
Oh, yeah. Silent Running.
Silent Running. Catherine, if you like robots and
yeah,
silence.
It was one of the few science fiction movies released, you know, in the rush after 2001 until kind of Star Wars made it legit again. If you haven't seen Silent Running, you should, and you consider yourself
will,
a geek or
I
nerd,
do, like,
do that. And what is the...
Gillespie just gatekeeped my nerd girl, and I'm going to let that
also
ride.
Also, A Boy and His
okay.
Dog, the horrifying post-apocalyptic, super misogynistic movie that with Don Johnson, based on a Harlan Ellison story. Yeah, yeah,
a Harlan Ellison story. Yeah, which is great. Soylent Green also came out around that era.
And damn it, I'm blanking on the movie that I love.
Saturn
the very
V
most.
with Farrah Fawcett Majors.
Damnation Alley. No, Damnation Alley.
Oh yeah, Damnation Alley is the one with George Peppard.
Yeah. It's a post nuclear hellscape,
post apocalyptic. Yeah, with Paul Winfield as well.
Who gets eaten by cockroaches? Just gonna throw that out there in case anyone has a cockroach
alert.
Problem. But like it's a problem to Nick.
No, it's a big problem.
What have you been consuming besides cockroaches?
You know, so I, over the past week, I read a new novel by Lauren Euler named Fake Accounts. She is best known, until this is her debut novel, as an acid-penned reviewer of other novels and of the literary and cultural scene. And her story is about a woman who is a millennial who has a dull boyfriend she's going to dump after she gets back from the Women's March, after Trump was inaugurated. And then something, she finds out that he is running a 9/11 conspiracy Instagram account, and decides to, things go weird from there. But it's a funny book that is an interesting take on millennials. I just want to, she is known for kind of pushing back against the kind of moral righteousness of millennials, particularly in literary culture. Here's a couple of passages that I think get to the flavor of the book. The narrator, who is kind of her, but not, because this is playing with what's called autofiction, she says, "Although I too was a white woman living in Brooklyn, I of course did not identify as such, since the description usually signified someone selfish, lazy, and in possession of superficial understandings of complex topics such as racism and literature." About her, the boyfriend, she writes, "He said he was totally open to having a gay experience if the right guy came along, and he thought the fact that he had never had a gay experience said more about how terrible men were than it did anything about himself." And then she, I'll just, one other quick, "Millennials aren't middle class," they replied. She's talking about her friends ordering another $13 cocktail. She has a great line.
13 bucks for a cocktail, says, in Brooklyn. That's, yeah. I mean, that's a bargain.
It was set in the 20th
century. She's talking about a character says to the narrator, "After a moment of silence, she said in the bright tones of someone who just had started a gluten-free diet that she had stopped reading the news." It's a funny, funny novel. I don't, you know, I'm not sure how I feel about it completely, but it is it's worth a read, a deep read, and thinking about. It's Fake Accounts by Lauren Euler.
Nick, because we live in an age of technological wonders, I just ordered that right now.
There you go.
Here's something that
I look forward to talking
that I want none of you to order, and this is a dis recommendation, mostly to prevent Catherine from making a mistake, which will be seen as possible. Here, it's a movie that came out last year called Over the Moon. It is an animated co-production between Netflix and Pearl Studio. Peter, tell us what Pearl Studio is.
I don't know, man.
He doesn't know. Oh, my God. That's funny. No, I was just using you as a computer. Pearl Studio is the name of the Chinese film production company. The Red Chinese are out there cranking out animated product. And this is Over the Moon. It's a story about a sort of tween girl who lives with her parents and works in a little mooncake shop, little bakery, in a charming little Chinese village. And of course, she's only a single girl. She's very, very happy. One child in the family. At some point, mom gets sick because it's a animated story, and mom sort of dies. Spoiler alert. But she's always had a love of science and some fairy tale involving some person who goes to the moon. But leaves her lover on planet Earth. So she believes in this whole thing. And so the kid decides to build a rocket to go to the moon. So Catherine, animated moon, rocket, tween girl, like, you think you might want to do it.
No, there's danger.
The danger
here
is the red, right. Chinese. I'm not even making it up. It is it is such a bad movie. The animation is all terrible and horrible. A member of my family, and I'm not going to say which one, said, "This is why we can't allow China to go to the moon."
What happens on the moon? Do they start a colony?
What happens is, so she finds,
they start a movie studio. That's what China's doing now.
She finds the figure from mythology who went up there, who turns out to be this awful, almost like pop star singing songs, big production numbers to an adoring cast of Technicolor pastel blobs. about how she's ultra luminous and is like a super duper star and stuff. And it's like the awful song. Everything about it is just the colors are awful. There's sort of like these Alebrije type of figures from Coco, except that they're these dragon lions. But the animation is awful and ugly, and it's all like, you know, for the greater good of China. It's terrible. It is a wickedly bad movie. Perhaps the worst movie I've seen in at least I don't know. Six months. Since Mulan? No, Mulan's pretty good. I didn't see the live action Mulan. But anyways, yeah, don't see it. Over the Moon, garbage.
It's not great.
Thank you for protecting me from that. That was a genuine risk that you have just diverted.
Yes. Okay. Thank you all for listening. Please send us your listener queries to stop laughing. Stop with your snorting to roundtable at reason.com or a voicemail at 213-973-3017. Listen to all the Reason podcasts at reason.com/podcasts. And that's it. We'll see you next Monday. Goodbye.